Welcome back, everybody, to What Really Matters. I'm Tablet Deputy Editor Jeremy Stern with you in Los Angeles. I'm here, as always, with Walter Russell Mead, Tablet news writer, Global View columnist at The Wall Street Journal, and distinguished fellow at Hudson. Let's start with this week's news. First story of the week. The U.S. and its allies believe major missile or drone strikes by Iran or its proxies against military and government targets in Israel are imminent, according to people familiar with the intelligence. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and Foreign Minister Israel Katz have both threatened that if Iran does launch an attack from its own soil, then Israel would strike back inside Iran. Meanwhile, according to the New York Times, Iran is already operating a clandestine smuggling route across the Middle East, employing intelligence operatives, militants, and criminal gangs to deliver weapons to Palestinians in the West Bank, with the goal of fomenting unrest against Israel by flooding the enclave with as many weapons as it can. Walter, news or faux news?
Well, it's, in a sense, it's faux news because it's old news, particularly that part about smuggling arms to the West Bank, hoping to make trouble there. I am afraid it's, the Israeli attack on the consulate in Damascus, the very successful decapitation strike. Iran has to do something. What it's going to do, we'll see. We should remember the Iranians, for all the other things that they are not stupid, especially not tactically stupid. Let's not forget they've been running rings around both Israel and the United States in the Middle East for a decade or more. And the Hamas attack was a total surprise, not simply the date, but the capabilities Hamas has had. That was an Iranian success against Israel. In spite of all the efforts everyone has made to keep Hezbollah from developing new capabilities and having new arms, it is clearly a far more formidable force than ever before. You look at the Houthis that apparently have this capability of stopping, a sort of ragtag militia band has now the ability to block commerce in the Red Sea. Iran is running the table. So when we hear these intelligence reports or whatever, first of all, we have to understand this is a government that's not been very good at anticipating or understanding Iran's moves. So they've gotten all of these other things wrong. Who knows? Maybe they have this right. I have this feeling if they're right, it's more by chance than because the super sleuths have figured something out. I also note that one of the things the Hamas people seem to have done is they've realized that Israel had great SIGINT, and so signal intelligence, and so they turned it against them by having staged fake conversations on phones that they thought the Israelis were listening to, et cetera. Why the Iranians couldn't do this, I have no idea. So I think what we have to fall back on here is Israel has attacked Iran, and a place and time of its choosing, Iran is going to give a response that will be calculated, number one, to show everybody that Iran is not disheartened or weak or accepting an Israeli attack so that it's standing up for itself. And number two, will do as much damage to Israel as possible and to the United States. And to do that, they are not necessarily going to prioritize military damage, political damage. They love the way that the Hamas attacks on October 7th have gone now into this war where Israel is and Jews are being attacked all over the world. And so this is they're feasting on the misery and the fear of Jews around the world. They want this. And so why do we think that they're going to do a response to this attack that is in some ways less? Particularly, I think, when the U.S. seems to be taking the stand that, we're not going to be retaliating here. If you don't force us, we won't retaliate.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of that political impact, if Iran does hit U.S. targets in the region as retaliation for Israel strikes, I mean, God forbid, how do you think it would play out politically in America? Because on the one hand, it will be directly tied to the Israeli strikes in Damascus. And on the other hand, Iran and Iranian proxies have been hitting U.S. forces and diplomatic targets in the region for months, for years, even before October 7th.
Well, you know, and it could also take the form of attacking Americans on American soil. Iran has a very long assassination list in the United States. I had dinner last night with someone, I won't say who it was, but someone whose name is on that list and hasn't been given U.S. government protection because of it. Then, you know, let's not forget that for months, years now, our southern border has been largely open to anybody who really wanted to cross. Has anybody come from Iran? Has anybody come who's willing to take money from Iran? So I think we should assume that Iran has options that they're not telling us about, and that our own somewhat phlegmatic security apparatus in the US isn't on top of. But that said, I don't think it's Iran's goal to precipitate a war between the United States and Iran. They would be, their ideal thing would be a strike bold and humiliating enough that it makes the United States look weak if we don't retaliate, but not so overwhelming that we have no choice but to retaliate. And they would hope in that case Biden would follow the sort of now traditional Democratic policy of half-hearted retaliation that ends up kind of demonstrating your weakness.
All right, our second story. The National Health Service in England has started restricting gender treatments for children, making it the fifth European country to limit the medications because of a lack of evidence of their benefits and concern about long-term harms, according to the New York Times. England's change resulted from a four-year review released this week by Dr. Hilary Cass, an independent pediatrician. The NHS will no longer offer drugs that block puberty, except for patients enrolled in clinical research. And the report recommended that hormones like testosterone and estrogen, which spur permanent physical changes, be prescribed to minors with, quote, extreme caution. Walter, news or faux news?
Well, I suppose it's news that even human beings can't entirely escape the consequences of common sense. That at some point, even the sort of craziest, nuttiest, farthest, you know, decentered minds around will suddenly realize that, suddenly or slowly realize that they've been committing absolutely horrendous, horrific child abuse, and doing it for years, and doing it with the applause of much of polite community. It's shocking. People 100 years from now, people will be wondering what was the nature of the craziness that kind of overtook people where this seemed reasonable. What to me is deeply shocking is that the United States is so slow. In the UK, they're still divided, with Scotland sort of passing crazy laws that, you know, it looked like they would be arresting J.K. Rowling until, you know, she basically dared them to come after me. So, you know, you still have the split consciousness in England, where certain elements of the, so sort of very, in England, in the UK, excuse me, where certain elements are so sort of quote woke that they're still, you know, running around screaming. And then on the other hand, the more sober medical profession is taking a good hard look at what they've been up to. I just hope that the day comes soon in the United States that we stop doing life-altering medication and surgery for 12 and 13-year-olds going through some kind of a phase, or for that matter, 15 and 16-year-olds. It seems to me that if you are too young to consent to for a sexual encounter, as in fact they are, you are also too young to consent to a permanent alteration of your body.
Do you have a theory of what accounts for the U.S. being such an outlier here? I mean, the Times report notes that the U.K. now joins Finland, Norway, France, and Denmark in concluding that the medicalized approach to youth gender distress is unsupported by medical evidence. Is it just that the U.S. is kind of running behind and you'd expect us to eventually catch up with the realization, or is there something else that's kind of pushing us to stubbornly commit to this?
Well, I never thought I would find myself in that kind of old democratic social thing of thinking, why can't we be more like Scandinavia? But why can't we be more like Scandinavia on this issue? I think, you know, what part of it, Jeremy, frankly, is that when you have a single payer or a largely government-centered thing. These things get taken on a direct policy level. In the US, the way these things would be working is with insurance companies, with different hospitals, with different medical boards and medical regulators, so that I think anything, good or bad, sort of moves through our system in a different way. At least I think that's part of the answer.
All right, final story of the week. Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world, has agreed to normalize diplomatic ties with Israel, according to a report in Ynet News. The diplomatic breakthrough, which follows 3 months of quiet negotiations between the countries, will be accompanied by Israel dropping its objection to Indonesia's application to membership in the OECD, which requires the unanimous consent of all 38 members. Israel had been working to normalize ties with Indonesia prior to October 7th, but those efforts were believed to have been shelved with the outbreak of the war, particularly after Indonesia supported South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Walter, news or faux news?
We'll see. Indonesia moves slowly as a country. You know, it's when I was a kid, we were taught it had 13,000 islands. I believe the number has now grown to 17,000 islands. And it has many different religious, ethnic tendencies, groups, different cultural trajectories. So it takes, you know, Indonesia often reaches decisions slowly. I know I've talked to a lot of the people that have been involved in this over the years. There has been this move. Interestingly, the Australian Jewish community has actually worked with this, because Indonesia, as a neighbor of Australia, is a great concern of people there. And I've met with very, very senior Muslim leaders, leaders of Islamic organizations who visited Israel or who have expressed an openness to it. So there's been a sentiment all along. Part of what has been holding it back was that the more radical jihadist and Salafist groups were getting a lot of funding from Saudi Arabia that was pushing them in another direction. I suspect that to the extent they're getting any messages from Saudi Arabia, they're getting different ones now. So that may be helping to change the calculus. The other thing in Indonesia is, let's not forget that October 7th wasn't the only thing that's happened in Indonesia recently. They also had a presidential election. And often things can happen after elections that aren't going to happen in the run-up to elections. So interesting, could well turn into something significant. It does, again, reflect the reality that larger and larger groups of people in the Islamic world are seeing this situation and this conflict through sort of a normal political lens, rather than through simply a kind of a religious essentialist lens. But let's see how it develops.
All right, that does it for this week's news. Let's have the big conversation. So Tucker Carlson continued his decline into crankery, I think we can say this week, Walter, with an interview with Reverend Munther Isaac of the Evangelical Lutheran Christian Church in Bethlehem, in which both host and guest inveighed against American Christians for supporting Israel. They both made a number of claims about what they called the Israeli persecution of Christians, but to give our listeners a sense of the general quality of the discussion, Tucker, in his opening monologue, referred to the 2002 siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, in which gunmen from Fatah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad took around 200 hostages into the church for a 39-day siege when an Armenian monk was wounded. And the way Tucker referred to this incident from 2002 was, quote, "A Christian clergyman was killed with American weapons, and Christian clergy in our country said nothing. If you wake up in the morning and decide that your Christian faith requires you to support a foreign government," meaning Israel, "blowing up churches and killing Christians, I think you've lost the thread," close quote. Walter, you are the world's expert on Christian Zionism in America, so please parse this for us. What was Tucker trying to achieve here? Are there existing cleavages he's trying to exploit, or what is the actual state of Christian Zionism in America now, 6 months after October 7th?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot more people who understand more about Christian Zionism than I do. I'm not gonna wear the crown you offer me, Jeremy. I do think several things are going on. I think it looks to me as if the quality of the research that Mr. Carlson is getting from his staff has declined precipitously since he left Fox News. And I say that because regardless of, you know, your viewpoint and your general take, there's just a lot of what's going on. There's sort of uncritically regurgitated propaganda lines. Some of them sort of Palestinian Islamist lines with a little bit of a Christian twist on the surface. Some of it sort of standard anti-American propaganda, the kind that if you spend a lot of time listening to Russian news outlets, they're going to pump you full of this. Some of it coming out of various, there are voices in the Arab Christian world where some of this happens. But let's talk a little bit about the really difficult position, because, by the way, I've traveled a lot in the Middle East over the years and met with many Christians and visited many Christians in the Middle East. And it's not a nice place to be a Christian. There is a lot of persecution. There's a lot of prejudice. The Christian community in the Middle East has been diminishing for centuries. And we are seeing a kind of an acceleration of that in the last 30 years. Absolutely the case. But the idea that somehow, the fact that it's been going on for centuries would suggest that possibly Israel isn't responsible for, is not the root cause of the problems of the Christians in the Middle East. We can just say that. At least as I've talked to Christians in Israel and from Gaza and the West Bank, I get a kind of a mixed picture. That is, Christian Arabs in Israel are often sympathetic to the Palestinian national cause, but are glad that they live in Israel rather than in other parts of the Middle East. And I've seen statistics that would say that actually the only country in the Middle East where the number of Christians is actually rising is Israel. And certainly when I visited Bethlehem while it was still under Israeli occupation before it's kind of returned to Palestinian control. There are fewer Christians in Bethlehem today than there were when it was under Israeli control. Now, that is partly because the occupied territories are not doing well economically. And in fact, many Palestinian Christians are following millions of Arab Christians in emigrating to the United States. And the Arab community in the United States is something like 50-50 Christian Muslim, because, again, for hundreds of years, or, well over 100 years, certainly before the establishment of the State of Israel, emigration to the United States was one of the ways that Christians in the Middle East, like people from many other parts of the world, could improve their situation. So to sort of try to, draw this one-to-one line of American support for Israel and the suffering of Christians in the Middle East, it's just, you would fire a research associate who gave you that if you had a lot of deep knowledge about the reason. Even if you wanted to make trouble for Israel, you wouldn't. This is not the way you would do it if you had a competent research staff. So my advice to Mr. Carlson, to Dr. Carlson, is get yourself some better researchers. If you're having trouble finding them, I can give you a list, and I think you'll find that you'll actually get more done if you base your analysis on a sort of sounder empirical platform.
I'm sure you've noticed that in the last few months, right-wing anti-Semitism has really been cascading on Twitter. And it's also coincided, like Tucker himself, with a kind of increasing hatred or maybe dislike of America, and also a growing admiration of foreign dictatorships like Russia and China and Iran. What's going on this part of the American right? And what's the connection between the anti-Semitism the dislike of modern America and the appeal of foreign tyrants?
First of all, let's just say that, and I know this is going to shock a lot of our listeners, but Twitter is not real life. X, excuse me, the platform formerly known as Twitter, is not real life. It is in no way representative of anything that a random sampling of public opinion would tell you. And I know this is going to be even more shocking. Many of the accounts on Twitter are not actually operated by real people, but are bots of various kinds. And some of them deliberately produce disingenuous material intended to foment discord and unhappiness in the United States. So if you were taking your analysis of what's going on in America by what you're seeing on your Twitter feed, you are making a profound and dangerous mistake. I'm not saying I use Twitter for things, but that's not the way I try to find out what my fellow citizens are thinking. So I would be very interested to see if polling showed any significant support for these sort of anti-American / anti-Semitic / anti-liberal / pro-dictatorship ideas. I don't imagine that Vladimir Putin would win a primary in any American state. And I can't imagine that a lot of people think that Saddam Hussein and Assad are misunderstood good guys who are a victim of American and Jewish plotting. This is, you know, this most of this has kind of Russian fingerprints on it, I would say. It tallies with lines of propaganda that the Russians have been developing. One of the things that people should remember is that during the Cold War, while the Soviet Union, in fact, is historically bears more responsibility for the creation of Israel than the United States did, I've written in my book, The Ark of a Covenant, that Stalin actually had more to do with Israel's independence than Truman. And I believe that's true. Nevertheless, very quickly afterwards, the Soviet Union became a kind of a leader of a global anti-Zionist crusade, and communist propaganda worked up every possible line of attack on Israel, on its relationship with the United States. And it would be tailored sometimes for Arab audiences, sometimes for European audiences, Latin American audiences. You know, it's an industry, a propaganda industry. One of the things that Putin has been doing is trying to revive it. Now, for many years in Putin's rule, he was actually pretty pro-Israel. And there are a lot of reasons for this. And in fact, again, I think I might have even said on our podcast that I would be more worried about intelligence and tech leaks from Israel to Russia than from Israel to China. Because there actually were, you know, large numbers of Russian immigrants, some of whom were Jewish, some of whom had simply bought false papers saying they were Jewish, who came to Israel in the years after the fall of the Soviet Union. And if you look at the way the banking system of certain countries, like I could name Cyprus, but why would I do a thing like that, where, you know, there's sort of playgrounds for Russian money and so on, where, you know, also Israeli money went. So lots of connections there. And Putin sees and saw benefit in that, wanted to keep it going. And of course, the more Israel became a tech mecca, the more interested he was in that. And I remember at one point, Putin actually took a walk around the old city of Jerusalem, commenting on the Jewish nature of the old city. You could not find something that would be more offensive to the standard Palestinian narrative of the history of Jerusalem. And there were oil and gas interests in common and so on and so forth. So, but Putin has decided, as his antagonism to the United States has grown, and as his sort of need to sort of do the war in the West and look for allies, and perhaps to deal with radical jihadi opinion in his own country, which we've seen recently is in fact a problem for him, has decided that there's more diplomatic gain to be had from dumping Israel than there is tech and economic gain from keeping it. And so Russia is resuming its historic role, which of course it had under the czars, as a chief producer of anti-Semitic propaganda of the highest degree. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion is a Russian forgery. And anti-Semitism is, you want to talk about anti-Semitism on the American right, anti-Semitism is the sort of mother's milk of the Russian nationalist right. Putin has re-engaged with this tradition domestically. He is engaging with it globally, and I think is weaponizing it to the best of his opinion. This is why someone like Tucker Carlson, who I think for all of the things you most one doesn't necessarily agree with that he comes up with, I don't actually think his ambition is to be known in the United States as a propaganda mouthpiece for Vladimir Putin. Don't actually think that he feels that that's where his political ambition and his career has been leading him. And this is again why I think he needs to be getting some better sources of information, because clearly there's a tremendous vulnerability in that organization to repeating the most egregious and unconvincing Russian propaganda talking points in the most unconvincing way.
All right, that does it for the big conversation. Let's end on the tip of the week. Your recently returned from South Korea, Walter, where the opposition Democratic Party won a landslide victory in parliamentary elections this week. So for our listeners who haven't yet been to the country, give us your number one South Korea travel tip.
It really is a wonderful country. And no country, I think, has done better than South Korea since, you know, the end of the Korean War. And literally, at one point, their living standard was well below sub-Saharan Africa. Now it's above most European countries. They were under a pretty ugly dictatorship for quite a while. They have a vibrant and robust democracy. In fact, we appear to be learning lessons from Korea. I don't know that they're the right ones, but basically, you know, each incoming administration imprisons its predecessor. So we appear to be doing our best to follow the South Korean trail to whatever. In terms of beautiful things to see and great experiences, first of all, Korean food. I don't think I have to actually tell someone who lives in Los Angeles that Korean food is not to be missed. And there's more of it, and it's better in Seoul even than in Los Angeles. I'm one of the rare people who actually went to North Korea before I went to South Korea. And what I found in North Korea, the only great food experience I personally had in North Korea was the kimchi, which is actually really quite good. And clearly, you know, communism has not been able to drive the North Koreans from their kimchi skills. And it actually has also helped create some bonding moments for me, even in those very difficult place when people find out about that I liked kimchi, they liked me more. You know, I guess, well, you'll be the last of the running dog capitalist imperialists that we kill. And in South Korea, you know, what I found, obviously, you know, that a lot of the food is the same and a lot of the love of the national culture, and to sort of see the way Koreans identify, how Korea, this not a large country by population, not tiny or insignificant, but not large, this deep attachment to a national culture and history and narrative is a fascinating and really beautiful thing to see. So I would say the best thing to see in Korea is the Koreans.
All right, there you have it. Thanks to our producer, Noam Bloom. Thanks to Will Cummings at Hudson and my co-host, Walter Russell Mead. I'm Jeremy Stern. We'll see you next week. And until then, please go rate and review us. This helps other people find the show.